Putting into something meaningful. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more.
Hi, this is Gloria Steinem, and you're listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles, 112,000 watts of progressive free speech radio.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we're looking at what's being sold to the world as peace in Ukraine and what it looks like from the standpoint of Ukrainians who are actually living through the war. The Trump administration's 28-point peace plan for Ukraine, drafted behind closed doors by his real estate ally Steve Witkoff and a Russian sovereign wealth fund chief, reads less like diplomacy and more like a property deal. Russia gets the land, the U.S. takes its cut, Europe foots the bill, and Ukraine is told to choose between surrendering now or surrendering later. We begin with Ukrainian political analyst Oleksandr Kiselov, a socialist from Donetsk and a researcher at Uppsala University. His recent writing argues that what's on the table is not just peace at all, but an imperial carve-up, and that the Ukrainian left is fighting for what he calls the least unjust peace. We then go inside Ukraine with journalist Alyssa Ursler, whose new report from Kyiv captures what this peace plan looks like through the eyes of people living and fighting there. She spoke with soldiers, left intellectuals, and ordinary Ukrainians in bookstores, on streets, and during funeral processions, delaying air defenses, increasing civilian deaths, and deepening Ukrainians' sense that their fate is being negotiated without them. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to the show. I'm Susie Wiseman, and I'm now joined by Oleksandr Kiselov, a Ukrainian left-wing writer and activist from Donetsk, and a member of the group Socialny Rukh, or Social Movement. He's currently a research assistant at the Department of Government at Uppsala University in Sweden, and he's been writing extensively on the war and on Ukraine's struggle for self-determination from a democratic socialist perspective, most recently in Jacobin, where he describes the Trump administration's peace proposal as an imperial carve-up, and in a new analysis for the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, where he argues that Ukrainians are forced to fight for the least unjust peace that can realistically be won today. His articles have also appeared in Spilne or Commons, in Jacobin, in Solidaritet, from Denmark, Classic Company in Norway, excuse my pronunciation, L'Anticapitaliste in France, among other outlets. Oleksandr's work offers some of the clearest analysis of the new so-called peace plan advanced by Donald Trump's envoy and welcomed by Moscow, examining how the plan would force Ukraine into permanent vulnerability and why any settlement imposed from above without justice or security guarantees risks laying the groundwork for future war. He situates this within Ukraine's current realities: overstretched military forces, political fracturing, corruption scandals, and a dangerous dependence on inconsistent Western support. So with all of that, Oleksandr, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here for the first time.
Thank you, Susie.
So maybe we should just begin with this so-called peace circus and ask for our listeners who haven't been following every twist, what does this plan actually do? And why do you say it reads like a real estate deal rather than a peace agreement?
Well, one of the most prominent parts of it was about prospective economic cooperation between the United States and Russia, including even how to divide the frozen Russian assets and how they're going to be used. And even talking about reconstruction of Ukraine, it assumes that there will be some profits, 50% of which have to go back to Washington. And you go step by step on this plan, and that seems that this is the most detailed part of it, because what is most important for Ukraine at the moment, serious security guarantees, legally binding, it's not there. And a lot of things talking about what was like NATO stationed troops in Ukraine seems so vague, or what are the European fighter jets and why they're supposed to be in Poland? It is less clear. So that's the main thing that led me to be calling it like this. But of course, the plan has changed, as I understand. Now they're trying to be more discreet, and we don't know exactly what is, and it's probably constantly changing.
But it's really interesting because you said that once again, just as it did when Trump was trying to get his hands on the so-called rare earth minerals of Ukraine, that all profits would go to the US or 50% of profits would go to the US. And I can understand why you call this a real estate deal, because actually it was written up by a real estate mogul. So another thing that you did in your Rosa Luxemburg piece is you describe these peace initiatives as a kind of Groundhog Day, where Washington periodically opens up talks with Moscow, floats a terrible peace plan or proposal, then pressures Zelensky and Kyiv, and then some demands get softened, and then Putin returns to his maximalist goals. So maybe it would be good for our listeners if you could walk us through some of this pattern and why this latest iteration that you've been writing about feels even worse.
Well, it all started developing after the meeting in the White House, first confrontation between Zelensky and Trump, after which the peace deal started coming up. I think at least two of them were authored by Witkoff. I think first one was in April, very simple, I think not so detailed, not 28 points. Then there were talks actually in Istanbul between Ukrainian and Russian delegation. Russian delegation prepared their own memorandum. The same came from Ukraine and European allies. And then we come to this 28-point plan, which was also shortened by in the European counter proposal.
Is that
And
the
now it seems
19-point
like
plan?
19-point plan. Now they say it's 20-point plan and several other plans
But they
on
all come back
different
to the same
aspects.
thing, right? They come back to essentially what I think you called Russia's wish list.
Yes, because the core Russian demands, they don't change. We can see that Ukraine was quite keen on including the humanitarian parts, and they were in this 28-point plan. Ukraine was talking about gradual sanction relief. It is in the plan, although there is no snapback mechanism. What was super important for Russia, it's getting the recognition of their territorial conquests in Ukraine. It keeps appearing over and over again, and Putin is quite straightforward in Bishkek or even in India recently. He says that they either take it by military force or Ukraine has to withdraw its troops. And the same we are talking about demilitarization of Ukraine, making it a permanently neutral state without any security of its own, basically having to accommodate to concerns of Russia. And
So,
then there is this denazification part, but I think it's more of like ideological symbolist victory for them. So like they have this sort of concessions, at least seems from the plan when they refer to European conventions, which is very obvious thing, but maybe then they can claim a victory because that's big part of their propaganda.
another part of what you've been writing about is this imperial carve-up, and now you've just sort of described it. You know, it seemed like you have two big powers that are essentially dividing up Ukraine without Ukraine's input, or I think you said that they're largely spectators. So this is not what we would normally consider a negotiated end to a war, that is usually between the parties in the war, and this time one party is left out. So I think this is what you're calling imperial. But then there's this other part that we're beginning to see, and this is outside of what we need to cover in this interview, but a sort of return to a 19th century view of the world that carves up spheres of influence. And so, in a way, Trump is now calling it, I think it's going to be called the Trump Row Doctrine, or, you know, like a rewrite of the Monroe Doctrine. And then you have the Putin version, which, you know, is becoming clearer now than it was, you know, when the war first broke out, because it seemed very much that the war wasn't going to take place. It surprised absolutely everybody. Putin miscalculated and thought he could run over Ukraine in 3 days in a blitz, and the world was shocked by Ukraine. Ukrainian resistance and resolve. And now here we are, unfortunately, almost coming up to the fourth year of the war. And it's really interesting because Russia is essentially weak in the sense of its economic influence over the world, and it's become weakened even more by the war. But it is a country with nuclear weapons and with great pretense.
Sure.
And so it gives to itself permission to negotiate what's going on in the world and certainly to change the architecture of peace throughout Europe, you know, getting rid of NATO and considering Ukraine their little brother, not really a country, not even giving any, I guess, credence to the legitimacy of the Ukrainian language, culture, traditions, everything else. So it's quite extraordinary. One might even think arrogant and, you know, full of hubris for Russia to take this upon themselves. But on the other hand, you do have the situation in Ukraine, and you bring this out in your article in Jacobin that Ukraine is deeply dependent. It's dependent on the United States for weapons. It's dependent on Europe if it would ever really step up and take those frozen assets and help finance further support for the war. But even its internet, you know, through Starlink, that this all depends on individual business owners or on the United States or on others. So, So how do you see that in terms of what Ukraine is able to do in these negotiations?
Apparently, Ukraine is can't do much. And this is the biggest issue that is on the table, because we can hear, I mean, like, there are probably a lot of things we could be angry about in the Trump national security doctrine that was released. But the basic fact that Europe is very often not capable to act united, it is fundamentally dependent on the United States in terms of security, at the very least. And even if European leaders, they support a just peace, they support Ukraine and Ukraine's fight to the victory, they can't do much on their own because they don't have this capacity. Simply for the last, there was over 30 years, I guess, since the Cold War ended, there was no investment in defense. Because why? And it reminds me of the situation in Ukraine, because again, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine became independent. There was no point in having an army. We have one of the largest armies in Europe, because who are we going to fight with? The Cold War is over, so whoever is in the West is not our enemy. And why in the world we would fight with Russia, with whom we've been in the same state for many years and share a lot of cultural traits? And this part was severely neglected. And then it also comes with all these neoliberal reforms, both in Europe and in Ukraine. So all infrastructure is neglected. It's privatized, it's downsized. And if the worst thing happened, in our case war, but could be also natural disasters, could be refugee arriving, and it is super hard to handle it properly. And it's not something that you can solve at the spot. Even if you can come up with the money, as when crisis comes, they find money, but it takes infrastructure to build. It takes people to learn how to use this infrastructure. And it does not come up on the spot. Even now, like with the Ukraine trying to recreate its defense industry, but the engineering schools are gone. They're hunting for old people who know how to do, at least who remember how to do things, because Ukraine was deindustrialized effectively over the years. I think it might not be so much different in Europe. It takes time, it takes efforts. But European left, for example, in our case, they just believe in peace. And we all want to believe in peace.
Right.
But we don't want to be caught empty-handed if it doesn't work.
It's interesting because this goes back to how much this war has changed the trajectory of the world, because in the post-breakup of the Soviet Union, it's logical that Europe at the end of the Cold War did not pay a lot of attention to defense. It's logical that Ukraine didn't either. But in this very short period, Ukraine has built up, which is now the most sophisticated army and the most, of course, battle-tested army in all of Europe. But in Ukraine, it seems, and you write about this, Alexander, that there's this notion that you can freeze the conflict where it is to get a breathing space, that this is what people see the peace plan as. Is that realistic? Is that possible?
Depends on Russia more, I would say, because that's the starting point or even of Ukrainian government. And the former commander-in-chief even wrote the column about this, that this is the only option that is possible because Ukraine is not managing. You can't resolve all the issues. Even the problem with the army, in part, is it that there is no replacement. People are exhausted of being always on the front line. You can't get proper rotations. You don't have time to prepare new people because other people, they don't want to go to the army because they're afraid to get stuck in the system, because they're afraid that without training, they'll be sent to just the battlefield immediately. And it's hard to resolve this during the war when its pressure is so high. So, of course, that will be something, a break to catch. But looking at Ukrainian infrastructure, looking at the Ukrainian industry, it is all strained to the brink. Also, we can talk about the legitimacy of the Ukrainian government, because there are no elections right now, and Ukrainians do not want elections during the war, because it's hard to imagine them happening right now. But there were no elections, and there is no this tool to somehow influence the government for them.
Right. And I think this is a really important point, because up until, let's say, the pandemic even, Ukraine was governed by a succession of oligarchs who basically robbed everybody blind. And the corruption was so endemic that Ukraine was a basket case. And then all of a sudden we see this lively tech sector and other young people who are very positive and forward-looking. And then Zelensky gets elected as the kind of anti-corruption, former comedian, TV star. He wins the sympathy of the world. And now, surprisingly, maybe not for people in Ukraine, but for people outside, to see that his own administration or his own people around him are now having to resign from corruption. And it's almost like the old oligarchs are finding their way back in and are able to bribe. I don't know, maybe you could talk a little bit about this, because it puts Zelensky in a very weak position while he literally is running around the world trying to drum up support to save Ukraine.
Oh, well, that's also might be connected to the issues of the war, because the power became super centralized. The office of the president, because basically just administration, it's his office, in fact. But Andriy Yermak, who was one of the leading negotiators, he became basically a vice president of Ukraine because of this war situation. And a lot of things, they were focused on these informal connections around president and how they were exploited, because the parliament was barely functioning. It wasn't a real parliament for many years already, because they don't treat it seriously. They just expect them to vote. They didn't appear in the parliament when they were called. There was no proper cooperation even on this level. And Zelensky's own party was collapsing in many small groups.
Right.
Because, again, like what you can do in this situation.
I was just going to say, because all of this feeds into the weariness of Ukrainians to just, can't we just finish this war or accept a peace plan, as I said before, that gives us a little bit of space? But it is such an existential war in the sense that one side wants Ukraine no longer to exist. And if there's no security guarantees, if there are no troops from Europe or elsewhere protecting Ukraine, the breathing space will just give Moscow, you know, the time to gather more troops, more weapons, and then start again. Am I wrong on that?
You're right on this, and that's what I can't understand from many people abroad, when they just make themselves sound happy about the peace is finally coming. Now we can breathe out and say, yes, it ended. We can return to what was there before, but it's not how it is. Ukraine has to be capable of protecting itself. Even in my article, I mentioned these three cases where there were unresolved territorial disputes, but none of them matches the plans that we've seen with the Trump deal. None of them. And if there are no security guarantees, What is the guarantee that the war will not break out tomorrow if there is no something ready to be deployed in Ukraine, for example, or react if the deal breaks out? Because Trump managed to close a deal on Gaza, but people keep dying in Gaza.
Right.
There were supposed to come peacekeeping troops where the troops are. So they
And I think
closed the deal, they shifted attention, but like we are afraid that this might happen to Ukraine. And that's like one of the reasons why people were hesitant even to consider any negotiation, because the whole effort was on mobilizing support, because we were afraid that once this negotiation start, people say, oh, well, they want to negotiate. What is there for us?
And as I, mentioned earlier to you, Alexander, this is a should be keeping people up at night in all of what used to be the Soviet bloc and the near abroad, because there's nothing, if Putin wins everything he wants here or most of what he wants here, there's nothing to stop him. You did your degree in Yerevan. Well, that conflict in between Armenia and Azerbaijan, I guess, would pale in significance if Russia then tried to take both of them back. Nothing is beyond comprehension here. It's all possible should Moscow get its way in this. So I think this is a good time for us to talk about the disappointment of not just the European left, but the left everywhere. One of the things that I found immediately once the invasion took place was to see how the so-called peace camp in the United States refused to even look at the situation on the ground. Ukraine had no agency. This was simply a US NATO war with Moscow. It happened to be fought in Ukraine, but Ukraine didn't matter and certainly didn't need to be talked to and certainly didn't need to be considered. This was a dividing line for me too. I broke with so many people I used to work with over this issue because it just seems, ABC in terms of solidarity, that Ukraine's sovereignty is at stake. Let's talk about Europe and about the left. Why solidarity is so important and why it's so hard to get.
Because Europe is our neighbor, the closest neighbor, and that's where people flee from Ukraine. Most of our refugees in Europe, logistically speaking, it's the countries that are able to offer support immediately. And that is also, even if you're probably we will not be NATO, nobody wants us in NATO, nobody ever wanted Ukraine in NATO. It was always Ukrainian government and some politician that were trying to force their way in. There was never interest from, it was never a mutual interest. Europe being a part of the European Union, it's some sort of European dream for Ukrainians that they were always wanted. It might not be a very rational dream, as many dreams are, but that's it was something that they were looking at. Because our closest neighbor, Poland, that pretty sure they have plenty of their own problems, but when you compare what Poland was before and what Poland is now, many people have seen that difference. A lot of Ukrainians, they go and live and work in Poland, and they did it even before the war started. That was what people were looking at. And right now, also, it's about being a member of the European Union is probably one of the few security guarantees, even formal, that Ukraine can get, because there is a mutual defense clause in the Treaty of European Union, something that is supposed to be legally binding, not like Budapest Memorandum, not like even friendship treaty we had with Russia, but something that binds many states together to actively support each other. And the European left reaction is not always something you would expect from them to understand, because they are stuck in this. Probably that's what campism is. They don't care about what is happening in Ukraine or what is happening somewhere else. They just assess it from the point Western imperialism is involved in this.
It's an
If
anti-Americanism, and it's also, that's what this anti-NATO sentiment is, and it's really stuck in the Cold War narrative. And it's almost like a reflex reaction. When I saw even Orthodox Trotsky supporting Russia, it was almost as if they forgot that the Soviet Union collapsed and that there was this knee-jerk response, well, we have to defend the Soviet Union. But oops, it's Russia now. It's a completely different place, and it has imperial expansion on it in
But it's
action.
deeply neoliberal and equal inside with corrupt establishment, with right-wing conservative policies.
I mean, Putin
It's
said from the beginning that he admired Pinochet. That was his model, forcing a neoliberal version of capitalism, but at the point of a gun, if necessary, and wiping out any internal opposition.
Yeah, but I mean, also in Europe, the problem that the left doesn't have any security policy of its own. That's it seems to me, that they just think that peace is the most important. We have to be the voice of peace. We have to constantly talk about this and think how to make it happen. But what if there is no peace? They have no answer to this. And they're talking about all this rearmament, like rearmament is the response to the long process of disarmament over 30 years. Yeah. And when Europe was threatened by the war with the Soviet Union, when Europe was threatened by the popular left party, like European establishment was threatened by this left parties inside, they managed somehow to combine both social security and military preparedness. This can happen again if you pressure them. But right now, they just ridicule. They're talking like there will be no Russian tanks in Berlin. There will be no Russian tanks in Paris because they can't take a few towns in Ukraine. But they don't have to go to Paris. They don't have to go to Berlin. They see United Europe as a problem, just like Trump does. So for them to break in this unity and dealing with each country on its own is what they want. If there is this NATO guarantees, if there are European Union mutual defense clause, just test it. Do small incursions with unbranded troops and see how, who do you react? Because we were talking earlier about this nuclear blackmailing. Mm. Yeah, but again, like if tomorrow Russian troops will appear in the Baltic states, wouldn't it be the same? So what? Why would you risk a third world war with a nuclear state for some small pro-American countries with rigid nationalist policies? No, we should be for peace. And then Russia gets what it wants, divided, weakened Europe.
That's very depressing, Alexander, because essentially what you're saying, your article uses the quote, the least unjust peace, but that there's actually no real solution right now, given the balance of forces. From your point of view, you're now in Sweden, but you're from Donetsk and you're in exile. So what is, I guess, the minimally acceptable future look like to you?
For me, this is exactly a pause, a break, something that makes Ukraine like restore some political process within the country, some minimum level of security, at least for a limited perspective, because even if right now we accept all Russian demands, there are two regions that they will not give up because they need them to connect to Crimea, Kherson and Zaporizhzhia, but they don't control them fully. So there is this dispute is there. It doesn't go away. So something that gives us time, gives us space. And Ukraine is not such a big country. Ukraine will never be able to make it on its own. So we need support. We need our neighbors to have credible left parties, to have credible security policies that goes beyond just words, beyond calling for justice, but not being able to stand up for this. And for this, we need international solidarity. For this, we need united Europe, at least, if not beyond that.
I want to thank you so much for those last sentiments and just say from your mouth to everyone's ears. And I want to thank you for your lucid analysis. Alexander Kislyov has been my guest. He's a Ukrainian left-wing writer and activist from Donetsk. He's a member of Socialny Ruch, which is a large left movement in Ukraine. And he's currently in Sweden working as a research assistant at the Department of Government at Uppsala University. You can find his articles widely on Jacobin. Thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome back to the program. I'm Susie Wiseman, and we're going to continue on the subject of Ukraine, but shifting from the structural picture to the human stories behind it. I'm joined by Alyssa Ausler, a freelance journalist and International Women's Media Foundation Fellow. She's based in Minneapolis, and her work focuses on social justice, law, and politics. Alyssa's work has appeared in The Nation, ZTO, Jacobin, Guernica, the LA Review of Books, and she's working on a debut novel. Alyssa recently returned from Kyiv, where she reported for ZTO on how Trump's much-touted peace plan for Ukraine looks to Ukrainians themselves. And earlier this year, she wrote a devastating piece in The Nation about the Alyenivka massacre, where dozens of surrendered Ukrainian prisoners of war were killed in a Russian penal colony. Alyssa's reporting shows how Ukrainians are experiencing the war and reacting to Trump's so-called peace plan. Her article, "With Peace Plan, Trump Rubs Salt in Ukraine's Wounds," this is the one that appears on Zetia and also on her Substack. It captures scenes that are impossible to convey from afar, spontaneous moments of mourning, the constant funerals, and the sharp sense that Ukraine's fate is being traded like a real estate deal. Alyssa spoke with Ukrainian leftists and soldiers, including Denis Pilash, Artem Chapai, Vladislav Stara-Dubsev, and historian soldier Taras Bilis, all who explain how Trump's actions have not only failed to bring peace, but have prolonged the war, increased civilian casualties, and emboldened Russian aggression. And a report shows how Ukrainians are wrestling with grief, anger, exhaustion, and a clarity often missing in international discussions about the war. So with all that, I want to welcome you to the show, Alyssa, and thank you for doing this reporting. I guess first, just before we get into it, I'm really curious because you've done earlier reports on Ukraine and on the war. So what drew you to the subject of Ukraine?
My original ties to Ukraine are actually personal. My great-grandparents were Ukrainian Orthodox priests. My grandfather on my mom's side was a war refugee during World War II. So for me, especially as a journalist, I had always wanted, even before being a journalist, I had always wanted to visit Ukraine because it's in some sense my motherland. And it's kind of unfortunate, honestly, that it was war that finally pushed that to happen.
Was that your first time to go, like during the war?
Yeah, in February for the trip that you mentioned where I was reporting on Olenivka. Yeah, so I had always kind of been, you know, on my radar, and then that it was the fellowship with the IWMF that made it possible. It's been a really interesting year, kind of both personally and professionally in that sense, because there is so much overlap of the two. Like, for instance, my mom grew up speaking Ukrainian in her household and then lost it as she got older. And then when the war started, was saying like, oh, now that there's all these interviews being translated on TV, I'm kind of remembering the language again. And that was just very impactful for me of like, I don't know, it's kind of my own version of the story of how there's like such suffering, but also beauty kind of woven in with it, was kind of the experience of a lot of the interviews that I was doing.
I was going to say, it's really interesting that I'm assuming you didn't speak Ukrainian as a child, right?
No, but I did not. No.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. But let's go back to your piece. Congratulations on writing it and on being able to do it. You open it. This is the one that appears in Zetia, in a Kyiv bookshop, where the conversation stops and people stand up because there's a funeral motorcade passing by. Maybe if you could start by describing that moment for listeners and literally why you chose to start there for the article.
Well, it also starts, that bookshop is situated, as I mentioned, blocks from Kyiv's Independence Square. And for people who haven't been, Independence Square was very important for protesters who were killed, part of the Heavenly Hundred in 2014. And then since the war, you know, the memorials have kind of just expanded, and it's a lot of memorials to fallen soldiers. So that scene, kind of, you have the collective memory, but then it really is, it's a massive bookstore. It's very busy, basically a cafe with people coming in and out. You know, we're in the middle of a conversation, you know, like a 2-hour conversation, you know, talking politics, when everybody at once, there's just a hush that falls over the room. And slowly everybody kind of rises to their feet and turns towards the window and watches as a procession goes down the street. And there's Ukrainian flags going out the windows. Spending any amount of time in Kyiv, like, memorials, grief, and processing are just such a big part of everyday life. I mean, another story that I'm working on that was kind of the peace plan article, you know, arose as a result of, you know, breaking news in a sense. My bigger piece that I'm, a more long form piece that I'm still in the process of working on, is actually more about rituals of grief and memorialization. Again, like I said, terrible but beautiful, like the way people are integrating this into their day-to-day lives and learning how to live with it. But it was a particularly powerful moment because I do think, as you alluded to, a lot of the discussions about the peace plan and diplomacy do kind of leave out the day-to-day experience of war, which even I think about it now, like I didn't have a full understanding of what life under occupation really meant until I was even in Kyiv hearing those stories. And so I think for most Americans, especially, like it's all very abstract. It's like, you know, there's a war, you know, there's attacks, but the degree to which it really infiltrates everyday life, I just felt like that scene, especially because we were discussing the peace plan explicitly, you know, it just really, that contrast just felt so stark to me in the moment.
So let our listeners know a little bit about the people that you decided to center in your reporting on this. I mentioned some of them in the intro, and they're people that I've interviewed here, except for Artem Chapai. That's a new one for me, and I'm definitely going to ask for his information. So these are people who are generally on the left and are active, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you learn from them about their perspective. And then we can go from there into talking about the actual plan as it came forward and what they said about it.
Well, three of the four people mentioned are, as you said, active members of the military. I actually got connected to Artem Chapai because I'm also working on a piece more broadly about Ukrainian literature. And he's a writer. So he has a book called Ordinary People Don't Carry Machine Guns that has been translated into English that I would highly recommend. That talks a lot about those kind of early days of the war and like the decision whether to enlist or not. It was interesting because we spoke during my interview, I was asking him initially about the book, and he describes being a kind of self-avowed pacifist and then having those views kind of challenged when the war starts. And I was asking him about that, and he was like, it's so interesting, like Western intellectuals always ask me about that point, while anybody in Ukraine asks me more about. He also describes the divide that happens between people who leave and people who stay. I learned so much speaking to him. But of course, with the peace plan in the ether, I was like, well, I have to ask you about the peace plan. And he was the one who explicitly said, this isn't a peace plan. Basically, he kind of told me to analyze the language, the equivalent to analyzing propaganda. It's much more akin to a partition like that of Poland in the 18th century. The last point was, you know, the attention span of global politics, there'll be another peace plan in a week and another one, you know, in a month. And he was right. By the time I was even writing my draft, it was completely different. And I mean, also, my first trip was in February, so right after Trump's election. So, I mean, this kind of span of a year that has felt like a decade, like a lot of Ukrainians know better than to trust what's coming out of Trump's mouth. There's also another soldier who is included in the piece just by his call sign, who pretty much just said, I've lost all faith in the U.S. as a result of these discussions. Mm. And that was kind of the general sentiment.
The other thing I was struck by, and I guess it was Chapai who said it, that, you know, likening it to the partition of Poland, which I hope our listeners know about how Poland disappeared from the map twice in its history, you know, divided between the Russian and the German empires, and then came back, and no surprise, it was fiercely nationalistic, as Ukraine is, because Ukraine, as we also know, Putin denies its existence, thinks of them as little brothers, the same attitude toward the language. But I think it was Chapai, and you quoted in your article, as imperialism at its purest. So I'm sure you talked to each of your interviewees or people that you met about that and about the language of the peace plan. I'm just curious about how widespread that view is, that it's you know, a partition and it's imperialism.
I think it is important to point out that the original 28-point plan didn't just say that Russia could keep the territory it's occupied and captured. It actually was ceding even more territory to Russia, giving Russia an inch in that regard, when really its ambitions, as you mentioned, are to erase Ukraine's national identity. And there's this entire, very imperialistic, very expansionist mindset that sometimes gets erased from public discourse. Taras Belousov's article that I first read was kind of pushing back against the notion that this is about NATO expansion, that this is a proxy war between East and West, because that too kind of erases Ukrainian sovereignty in a way.
There's no Ukrainian agency. And unfortunately, too much of the left here sees it as a proxy war. And again, ignores Ukrainians in the process and puts it all between NATO or the U.S. and Russia. And that's a theme in your piece about how all the negotiations are in secret or without Ukrainian input. And as they go from place to place, you know, that's been a criticism. So then they'll invite Zelensky or his team to the table, but that's not where the real, you know, discussion or decisions are made. So I wonder, because you mentioned it in your article, how ordinary Ukrainians feel about being shut out when their fate is going to be decided.
Well, I think it also circles back to where our conversation began. And that's kind of what Pilash said when we spoke about the fact that not only are you shutting out the voices of the Ukrainians who are surviving, but you're also in some way completely erasing the Ukrainians who have already been killed in this conflict. And so it's both about, you know, Ukrainian sovereignty and having Ukrainians at the table, but also about acknowledging the very real like loss and suffering and kind of on the ground reality of what this war has done, which did the displacement as well. When you're talking about occupied territories, again, it can feel very abstract to somebody who doesn't understand the sheer number of people who have already been forced to leave their homes. Like their homes maybe are likely destroyed, even if they were able to go back, there'd be nothing to go back to. I mean, Mariupol was razed to the ground. Some people have families still in occupied territories. Maybe they were displaced and now they aren't able to see their families. I mean, during my first trip, we were having dinner with a newspaper editor whose family, like she was from Crimea, and she started crying and was like, I haven't seen my family in 10 years. And I probably won't see them for the next 10 years, the way things are going. And so it's just like, again, like this talks of diplomacy, the kind of things that make headlines, it becomes very abstract. It becomes more like, yeah, kind of secret business negotiations. I mean, it's obvious the business incentives that, you know, are kind of motivating Trump, both in Gaza and in Ukraine, because there are parallels to be drawn there with these plans.
That was going to be my next question, because you talk about it as a business deal. And also just to go back, because I want you to go into this sort of way that, you know, the Gaza was the playbook, the Gaza so-called peace plan with Kushner and Witkoff, you know, as a real estate deal, a business proposal, and their real estate, you know, moguls, and they're shuttling between Moscow and Florida and you know, the Middle East. And talking about reconstruction deals and Arctic mining projects. And I think, you know, I was really struck by what you said in the bookstores. People have a life that they go on with, but then there's a funeral procession and everybody gets up, you know, and that there's this profound sense of grief and shell shock at the same time. And I just wondered what people said to you about reconstruction projects where burying soldiers and living under bombardment is all part of the sort of picture.
Yeah. Well, and even I think a lot of the abstractness of the language, I think, kind of furthers that erasure. I think that it's hard to have any kind of reconstruction without an acknowledgement of the scope of the suffering that has happened in recent years in both places. And I even think the notion that you can model a plan, a Ukraine plan off of Gaza itself erases so much nuance and kind of shows a lack of understanding or care for the actual people there. It struck me from day one that Steve Witkoff is a real estate mogul. Like I just, having him in this role, you know, like that tells you so much. I mean, it reminds me of, was it the Gaza like Riviera plan that Trump was, right. that Trump was touting? I mean, in my view, yes, I was going to say disgusting, grotesque. I mean, at a time when people are still being slaughtered every day in a way that I think it's going to take years, if not decades, for there to be true accountability for and true reckoning with the sheer scope of both that suffering and the war in Ukraine. I mean, I don't want to act like my two trips there make me able to, you know, comprehend the scope of the suffering and the loss. But I at least feel confident enough to say that the peace plan does very little to acknowledge it. And I mean, even the Trump establishing a board of peace and like appointing himself, I don't know, like he wants to brand himself a peacemaker. The hypocrisy in that, considering kind of how he moves and like his MO and the way he deploys violence when it's convenient for his agenda. Exactly. It's hard to take seriously.
Unfortunately, though, that's the reality that we're living under now. So I was going to ask you, because in your reporting and even in your piece on what happened at Aliovka, that I wondered, you know, as you met with people who lived through that, whether or not they talked about justice or talked about coping with the fact that the city they grew up with, if they were from Mariupol or elsewhere, you know, just literally disappears. And this, of course, is familiar to Gaza, but we're talking about Ukraine. People are permanently displaced, and yet they're watching peace plans being drawn up in which they have no voice. I just hear more.
I mean, one of the women I spoke to from February, her husband was at Olenivka when, like, during the attack that I was reporting on, which, for those not familiar, basically when Ukraine surrendered in Mariupol, they had kind of fortified this steel plant, and then, you know, Zelensky told them to surrender. All the prison, and but they were told that they would be exchanged shortly thereafter. The prisoners were taken to various camps, including Olenivka, which was already kind of notorious for abuses. But then in the middle, like randomly in the middle of the night, about 200 members of the Azov Brigade were moved to this industrial warehouse. And there was an explosion in which over 50 people died. Many more were injured. And despite the fact that, like, A, they were told that they were going to be exchanged much earlier, when they were actually sent to this industrial warehouse, many were under the impression that they were going to be exchanged. But on top of that, if you're injured, you're also supposed to be higher priority. So for, like, the wife of one of these soldiers, she, of course, spoke to me like, yeah, I'm grieving the loss of the place where I lived and my home. She actually said something along the lines of, like, we don't live here. We just exist. Everything is foreign to us. I mean, I think that captures displacement very well. But to her, what matters was people and, like, making sure people were returned and people were home safely. And so in the comparison, she's like, well, I would rather cede land than never see my husband again. But what a terrible, you know, two choices to have on the table. And that's the other through line of war, is like people making impossible choices constantly in which there's no right answer. But then there was another woman whose husband was actually killed in the attack, and his body was returned. And so she kind of moved to this kind of random suburb of Kyiv because she thought it would be safest, and he's buried there. And so now she's like, I could never leave here because that's where my husband is. Yeah, I mean, there's so much life that is being destroyed when we're talking about an occupied territory. There's so much violence that goes into the occupation. I interviewed a woman this trip too, whose son was killed on the fourth day of the war. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of unfathomable. I mean, she has, like, the CCTV footage of a missile hitting the house that he was staying in and showing me clips of it. And I just kind of was sitting with that, just being like, what a terrible thing to witness and have to process and to have to live with, you know. And he's a civilian. He's not a soldier or anything. So,
and then to have the footage and to be able to see it over and over again, mm-hmm. really awful. So these same people that you're talking to have been through so much. I'm really curious about their sort of attitude. One thing that you say is that Trump has worsened the war, prolonged the war. Europeans talk about helping, but have not been able to pull it together or to seize the assets, the frozen assets that Russia has. So Ukraine has shown tremendous stamina, resolve, resilience, all of that. And, you know, as you spoke to these people some of whom I also know, who decided finally they just have to fight, even mm-hmm. though they may have large disagreements with their government and with the system, but they fight for the survival of Ukraine as Ukraine. So did you see anger, determination, fatalism, especially as, you know, you get these peace plans that are like business deals?
Yeah. Well, it's also that kind of paradox of attacks in the night are normal, and yet that there are still outliers that kind of still jar people. I mentioned in the piece an attack on Ternopil that happened while I was there, which is a city very far west. And as Taras says in the piece, the impact that Trump has had in delaying Patriot missiles and things is that there are more and more civilian casualties further and further west. And so it's, at the same time, it's very visceral. It's very real. And it's not just the front lines. You know what I mean? It continues to kind of seep further west, more and more civilian targets. So I do think that contrast is stark. And also, as Taras mentioned when we spoke, it's one thing to have a ceasefire and or to have an agreement reach. It's another thing for actual aggression to stop, and another thing for Russia to commit to it long term. And he said, like, who knows, like another war, we could reach this year, and another war could start under even worse conditions for Ukraine.
That's one of the things that we spoke about in the prior interview, is that a lot of Ukrainians who have so much war weariness, battle fatigue, and grief and everything else are willing to say, okay, well, maybe we'll get a breathing space. But, you know, a breathing space to do what? Because if it starts all over again, it's not for me to say it that way, but it just seems like that'll just prolong it. You tended to speak mainly to people like soldiers, writers, artists, activists on the left, and other ones as well. And I wondered, you know, what their perspective was and what they're asking you to convey to people in the U.S. What kind of solidarity are they asking for and demanding?
I mean, I think the main thing is just support for Ukrainian sovereignty, like support for Ukraine to truly have a seat at the table at these negotiations is one thing. The sentiment also is like, we want this to end. You know, Ukraine wants peace, absolutely. But it's kind of that thing on what terms and at what cost. And another thing that was mentioned was the original kind of territory lines that were drawn would give Russia some of the most fortified positions. And so it's again, you know, just being aware of the kind of true nature of Russia's own stated goals and ambitions, I think having a fair degree of skepticism is not just like good critical thinking skills or, you know, like valid, but I also think it's the only way to really like take Ukraine's perspective and Ukraine's own longevity and Ukraine's sovereignty into consideration, is to, I think, approach the deal-making process with like a high degree of skepticism as to what the real motivations are and at what cost this so-called peace may be achieved.
I guess also just to add to that, because you mentioned it, Putin is demanding territory he doesn't control. And I wondered, you know, if people remarked upon that, you know, losing huge tracts of land. Is it, you know, are they resigned that that might have to be the case? Or, you know, is there more, did you see more resolve in a sense? Like, hell no, we'll fight to keep the Donbass. I'm just sort of curious because it is now almost 4 years.
The sense I got was that ceding extra territory was a red line. And Taras mentioned this as well, that when Trump first took office, there is much more appetite for just freezing the front lines as they stand. But ceding additional territory, I think the consensus was that would be absurd, given the fact that Russia is the aggressor in this situation. Why would you reward them with extra territory? While I feel like freezing the front lines is, like you said, more of an acceptable conclusion because of the fatigue of 4 years of war, because of the failed 2023 counteroffensive, because of the sheer scope of loss ingrained in day-to-day life. But ceding extra territory, like that just feels like handing them a gift on a platter and rewarding them for their aggression.
Yeah, it's really horrific. I guess just finally, because we're running out of time and I knew it wouldn't go so quickly as it does, what kind of sticks with you from your conversations about what people want the most, feel the most, and what you'd want our listeners to hold on to?
The thing that sticks with me the most is kind of the way that loss doesn't have a kind of clear ending or resolution. And so even if you have a bulleted list of things that do eventually get agreed upon, people's lives remain in shambles. People's lives are like forever changed, irrevocably changed. I spoke to one woman who was talking about how we can't even call it PTSD because the conflict is ongoing. There's no post. It's still happening. And even if there is a kind of pause in the act of fighting on the front, it doesn't bring anybody back. It doesn't necessarily change the degree to which lives have been completely upended. And I think it's very similar in Gaza, where, like I mentioned, the sheer scope of the loss is tremendous. There's so much that cannot be undone. There's so much that cannot be reconstructed in any way. And peace on paper is not the same thing as peace in practice. So I guess it is different because it's like when I say that, there's like specific faces and stories that come to mind that I'm associated with that I think about, you know, very visceral. I mean, even this mug that I'm drinking out of as I talk to you is like the mug of a, it's from an NGO called Voices of the Missing. And so it's all soldiers mm-hmm. who are missing. And so I spoke to a mother. It's kind of this notion of ambiguous loss where she doesn't know if her son will ever come home. She doesn't know if he's alive or dead. And like that to me, it's kind of just an unfathomable reality. And she is not alone in experiencing that. And that's what's so impactful to me is that so many people are kind of living through the worst case scenario. I mean, I also interviewed a musician who like dedicated her whole album that she just made to her boyfriend who was killed in the war. And I asked her, you know, how it kind of affected her art. And she said, actually, if anything, I'm starting to make happier music because like the worst possible thing already happened. Like the worst, for many people, like the worst case scenario has already unfolded, which is just the reality of it. It's just the reality of what war does, not just to a nation, but to families, to cities, to communities, to loved ones. It rearranges everything really fundamentally. And so kind of peace plan or not, like that has already happened. That is already happening. That's, I think, what sticks with me the most from my time in Ukraine.
And this, you know, that kind of what you're talking about, I was just thinking there's going to be a reckoning in Russia, too, because they've lost so many people. And when you were talking about, mm-hmm. you know, what happened, you know, with those soldiers and others who were kidnapped and tortured and then killed, then the one thing we didn't touch on, but we could do it in another broadcast, perhaps, is the children who were stolen and then sent to Russia. And that's part mm-hmm. of the demand. But mm-hmm. we really have run out of time. And I just want to thank you for your reporting and hope that you'll come back when you write this longer piece, as I'm sure it's extremely worthwhile. I think what we got out of today is so much more than just reading the headlines or even reading really good analyses of what's going on, because you brought a flavor of what it means on the ground to people who have to live through this every day. So let me tell the listeners, you can read Alyssa Ausler's latest piece on her reporting in Kyiv on ZTO. The piece is called "With Peace Plan, Trump Rubs Salt in Ukraine's Wounds." You can also look at her reporting in The Nation to see the other piece that we've talked about. I just want to wish you the best of luck and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Alexander Kisilov and Alyssa Ausler. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gotha, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows at kpfk.org. That's on its audio archives. Just scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. There's more information on programs and guests on our Facebook page. And you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and please pledge your support, 818-985-5735. And now stay tuned for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
KPFK's on-air winter fund drive has successfully wrapped up. However, KPFK's end-of-year sustainer campaign is one of the most important fundraisers of the year, and it's still going until the ball drops in Times Square. Monthly support gives KPFK stability we can count on, not just during drives, but all year long. We're hoping that you can help us reach 500 sustaining members by December 31st by calling 818-985-5735 and pressing option 2, or you can donate to become a monthly sustainer online at kpfk.org/donate. Happy holidays to everyone, and here's to more power to the people and people-powered radio in 2026.
It's the end of the year and taxes are around the corner. A great way to maximize your tax deduction is by donating your unwanted vehicle or boat to KPFK. Simply call toll-free 877-573-5288. Not only will you maximize your tax deduction, but you'll be supporting KPFK and its quality programming. Again, simply call 877-573-5288. Thank you for your support.
Peace, everybody. This is DJ Sean O, and you are listening to KPFK.